Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 21. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're doing two very, very different science fiction films. The first one is a 1957 relatively low-budget movie called Kronos, starring Jeff Morrow and George O'Hanlon. And the other one is a 1980 movie directed by Bertrand Tavernier called Death Watch, starring Romy Schneider and Harvey Keitel. This one isn't on anyone's radar, but it's a really interesting one based on a good science fiction novel. So sit back and we'll get things started. The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a podcast of speculative fiction, fantasy and horror appreciation. Feedback is very important, so Soylent Green, in fact, and you can give feedback via my email address, cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com. You can find the Paleo Cinema Cafe on the Book of Faces, or you can send a voicemail to area code 206-338-9397. Now, occasionally we do get some adult content on this podcast, so if you're easily offended by that, then you need to lighten up and accept the fact that the world is a diverse and wonderful place. Okay, how's everyone doing? It's November here, and on Tuesday, Melbourne gets a public holiday for the Melbourne Cup horse race. We get the best public holidays, but not enough of them. We get holidays for horse races and unsuccessful World War I invasions of Turkey and all sorts of other weird and wonderful things like that. So Tuesday I've got off. Monday I'm working from home, so I don't have to go into work until Wednesday. And on Friday I've got 2 weeks off. So it's looking like things are looking up here. We've got Sal's 40th birthday coming up as well on the 21st of November. So if you want to send your best wishes, chuck me a voicemail and I'll pass it on to her and embarrass her on the day. So things here, Sal's father's a little unwell, but apart from that, we've been going okay. Been watching a lot of movies and haven't yet caught up with Thor the Dark World. Though we are going next week to check that out. We'll probably do 3D because we've got the glasses, we might as well. But I'll just give you a bit of an idea about what I've been watching. Oh, by the way, before I do that, the radio gig with Ivor is still going great. I'm doing movie music again. I did all sorts of diverse things with that. For instance, last week, we ranged from John Barry's theme to the Ipcress file all the way through to Ethel Ennis singing the theme song from Mad Monster Party. So I'm throwing weird and wonderful shit his way, and it's going really well. The rapport's still there. We're having a half an hour of fun once a week. I'll get to go into a nice little TARDIS booth in Melbourne and talk to Ivor for half an hour in Darwin. And we play music that I like, which is a lovely little gig there. We're getting some good audience feedback from it, and so it's moving along nicely there. I've just got to keep things fresh by varying the music so we don't get into a rut. So I'm very aware of that, and I'm about due to send him some more sounds for next week, and I'll do so. But if you want to listen to it, Melbourne time, it's on at 10 p.m. Thursday nights at ABC Radio Darwin. I'll throw up the information on Facebook and also on Twitter. You can follow me with @paleocinema, one word lowercase, or Terry Frost as one word lowercase. And I'll always give a few hours notice for that before it appears on the radio. So what have I been watching in the area of genre films? Let me have a look. One of the great things, Halloween came up, and Halloween's just starting to be something here in Australia. It hasn't been in the past, and there are a lot of people going, we're in Australia, mate, we don't need fucking Halloween. But having said that, there are some upsides, one of which is you can buy lots of cool decorations in the stores. And the other one is that a whole bunch of Hammer films came out on Blu-ray from Shock Video just before Halloween. And we picked up a lot of them. They're really high quality. They've all been digitally remastered. They're in a double pack with a DVD and a Blu-ray version of the film. So you can give away the DVD version to friends if you want to. We got all sorts of good things like Plague of the Zombies, Quatermass in the Pit, the Quatermass Experiment, the Mummy Shroud. What else did we get? We got one of the Christopher Lee Dracula movies. I forget which one offhand. Frankenstein Created Woman, The Witches, The Devil Rides Out with Christopher Lee in it, and a whole bunch of them came out all at once as a bit of a surprise for us. And they're all reasonably priced too. They're about mid-price Blu-ray, so they're about $20 each year, which is not too shabby for a new release in the sense of being newly released on Blu-ray. And so we picked up a whole bunch of them, and I'd go out shopping and pick up a few of them, and then Sal would go out shopping and pick up some more of them. So we've got a whole bunch of quality Hammer remastered sitting around the house waiting for us to be on vacay to watch. Actually, it's a bit of a staycation because we're staying at home, really, and organising things for her party. So I've been watching a couple of those. We've already watched Plague of the Zombies, which was a lot of fun, and The Devil Rides Out, which again is a lot of fun, and a few of the extras on there as well. So if you're in Australia, I recommend you pick up some of those if they're still around. I think they're going to go fast, but they're well worth your time to pick them up. So what have I been watching? Watched I Married a Monster from Outer Space, which is always a bit of a fun one to revisit. Tom Tryon's a good actor, actually, to play a kind of distant and slightly bemused alien, given the fact that he was a closeted gay gentleman in Hollywood at the time, and that ambivalence about kissing his wife in the movie was fed into by his ambivalence of kissing any woman. So that was a little bit of fun. Let me see. We also watched The Reptile. That's one of the other Hammer films we watched. The Reptile with Jacqueline Pierce and Ray Barrett in it, Australian actor Ray Barrett, which was a bit fun. We rewatched Beetlejuice, which is kind of okay because it was on TV and we were sort of in the mood to watch it. Saw Kick-Ass 2, which was kind of okay, a bit more of the same in a sense. But we got the chance to watch that. What else? There were a couple of other things I wanted to mention here. Now, they've totally gone from the list. I'm not sure what I was thinking. But, yeah, so basically it's a good time for us to start buying cheap Blu-rays in Australia. And the Blu-ray shelf is bulging and about to burst open like a pod person's pod. And, yeah, so it's a good time to acquire genre films at a reasonable price if you look around. And also you get these great recommendations on Facebook. If you tap into the right Facebook groups or you have the right friends on Facebook, it's always a good way of finding cheap Blu-ray bargains to get for your collection. I know I've had a few discussions around the place too with people just working out whether buying or acquiring Blu-rays rather than digital copies is better or worse. And maybe it's a function of age, I don't know, but I really like having a physical copy of media so I can say that I own it in that sense. Of course, there are all sorts of rights issues, so you never really own a movie in a strictly legal sense, but in a physical manifested sense, you do own the movie. Whereas digital copies, there's not that same sense of ownership about. I mean, I've got a whole bunch of music that I've purchased on iTunes when people have given me iTunes cards. And I don't have the same feeling about them as I do of a CD or an LP or some other physical hold-in-your-hands manifestation of that medium. Let me know what you think about that, because it is a bit of a discussion. It's going to become more and more prevalent as physical media start disappearing from the shelves. Inevitably, I suppose it is going to happen. But if it does, I'll miss it. I suppose I won't disappear entirely, because media doesn't disappear entirely. There are still people making records, and there are still people even making 8-track tapes, and there are still people making cassettes of things. So the media won't disappear entirely, but they'll kind of fall to a lower level of visibility in society than they currently have. But I should actually tell you which movies I'm going to do. Remember last time around I said I was going to get a copy of Dune and find it and do Dune this time around. So I found my copy of Dune, which There are lots of different versions of Dune. There are almost as many different versions of Dune as there are of Blade Runner. And I found my copy of the Alan Smithy version, which is a three-hour long one, which doesn't have Princess Irulan at the start. So I start watching this version, and it's pan and scan. I didn't know that at the time because I've never watched it before, that particular disc. Starting there, 20 minutes in, the disc glitches on me. Totally spits a dummy, irretrievably fucked. So I'm going to have to wait till I can find a decent copy of Dune before I could do Dune, the David Lynch version, of course, on the Martian Drive-In podcast. I do apologise for that. I made every effort. I got the disc. I sat down on my bum. I got the coffee and the chips. I started to watch it, but the wheels fell off it. So I apologise for that. So we're not doing that this time. We're doing Kronos from 1957, which is a good little low-budget-ish science fiction movie. And we're doing Death Watch, which is from 1980, a Bertrand Tavernier film starring Harvey Keitel, Romy Schneider, and Max von Sydow, based on the D.G. Compton novel, The Continuous Catherine Mortenhoe, which has a number of other names in different markets, but that's the name that I knew it under when I read the book back in the 1970s. And I think it's a good science fiction movie, which has only one real science fiction conceit in it. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about the easier of the two films to discuss, being 1957's Kronos, starring Jeff Morrow.
Of infinity, a gigantic astral body hurtles towards the earth to terrorize and seal the doom of an unprepared mankind.
How can we prevent it?
A job for the army. They've got the guided missiles, the nuclear warheads. Intercept and destroy it before it strikes.
As if by design, this death-dealing meteor plunges into the depths of the sea. And in its place emerges an awesome monster such as human eyes have never seen. Kronos.
Unless stopped somehow, others will land and suck the earth dry of all electrical and atomic energy resources.
Now you're the only one that knows, and you will never tell.
A metallic vampire stalking the earth. Its purpose, to drain it of its energy, every last bit of vitality. Kronos, absorbing all the dynamic strength of this universe to make him so powerful as to withstand any force.
Kronos is a 1957 science fiction movie. Starring Jeff Morrow and George O'Hanlon. The premise of the movie is pretty silly, but I'll get to that in a moment. It was directed by Kurt Newman, who directed The Fly a year later in 1958, the original one with Vincent Price and David Hedison. The script by Lawrence L. Gordon and Irving Block. Irving Block wrote the story that Forbidden Planet was based on, for instance, and later wrote a couple of movies for Roger Corman, Viking Women, and War of the Satellites. So he's mostly known for writing and also for doing special effects. He did the special effects design for Kronos as well. And to be honest with you, he's done a good job with that. Now, the premise of the movie, as I said, is somewhat silly. Aliens from another world send a huge robotic accumulator to invade the Earth and absorb all energy it comes in contact with. So it's absorbing electrical energy and atomic energy. Now, we've got to settle this once for all. The premise is stupid because if you want atomic energy, they're 93 million miles away from Earth. There's as much as you're ever going to need. It's called the Sun. Why would you land on a little rock, have to mess around with all the little creatures crawling on it, to get a limited amount of electrical and atomic energy when you can get as much as you like from the Sun? Doesn't make a lot of sense, but, and people knew it at the time, but that's the premise, and it's, having said that, I kind of like the movie. It starts out a little bit like It Came From Outer Space, the Jack Arnold film from a couple of years before. A guy in a pickup truck's driving through the desert, and then the engine conks out, and the radio goes off, a little bit like Richard Dreyfuss did many, many years later in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And a mysterious light shines in his face and takes him over. He then drives to the local nuclear power and scientific genius place and immediately takes over the head scientist, a guy called Dr. Hubble Elliott, played by John Emery. And John Emery gets a bit of a rough trot in this movie. He gets electroconvulsive therapy. He gets hit with electrical panel electricity. He gets put into a psychiatric hospital and generally doesn't have a lot of fun with it like the other guys in the film. Now, working at the lab are Dr. Les Gaskell, played by Jeff Morrow, his beautiful girlfriend Vera Hunter, played by Barbara Lawrence, who works in the photographic lab there, and his mate Arnold Culver, Dr. Arnold Culver, played by George O'Hanlon, who runs a giant mega computer called SUSY, and they've got one of those scientific names for SUSY, and the acronym works out at SUSY. And it's enormous. It's like a factory-sized computer full of reel-to-reel tapes and flashing lights and all that kind of thing, and all of which is probably about as powerful as the display on an iPhone 4. And anyway, they find out that there's been an asteroid which is heading towards Earth, but it's moving in unusual ways. And meanwhile, their boss, Dr. Elliott, is making his plans for the aliens to take over the Earth and suck all the juice out of every power line and nuclear power plant on the planet. Eventually, the asteroid prangs into the Earth. Not like deep impact. The thing is probably about the size of an office building off the coast of Mexico. And they send Dr. Gaskell and Arnold Culver and Vera Hunter down to check it out in a helicopter, as you do. And they kind of go down and start their investigations on the beach and go for a swim and have a nice time and sit in a nice little shack on the beach in Mexico until the water off the coast starts bubbling and an enormous brutalist architecture monster comes out of the water. The interesting thing about the design of the monster is it's all geometric. It's a kind of a couple of elongated cubes, one on top of the other, with a big spindle running through them and a thing underneath them, a bit like an IKEA coffee table. And on top there's a dome and a couple of antennas. Really simple stuff. Really easy to scale up to enormous size with the visual effects, which is probably what Irving Bloch was shooting for. It's one of the most unusual monsters of the 1950s because it's so simple. It's basically, a kid could draw it because it's all rectangles and boxes. So they then decide they're going to land the helicopter on it, which, as you do, I mean, it's about the size of a large office building, and they land the helicopter on it. There's some really nice forced perspective and other special effects used to when they investigate the top of what they call Kronos, naming it after the father of Zeus, one of the titans of Greek mythology, and take a look in it, and there are all sorts of flashing lights and kind of domes and other groovy 1950s bits of special effect on there. And then Kronos starts moving and stomping its way across the land, sucking up electricity from power lines and power stations and nuclear research facilities, and they've got to stop it before it destroys all the power on the Earth. Now, The actors in it are kind of middling actors. Jeff Morrow played Exeter in This Island Earth, the first science fiction movie I ever saw. Doesn't have the big dome forehead in this one, but he's no less rigid and stiff. He never was a nuanced actor. As I said, Barbara Lawrence didn't do too much in the realm of the thespic arts. And George O'Hanlon's the most interesting of the three of them. He played Joe McDokes in all the short films in the 40s and 1950s. The little short films that turn up on Turner Classic Movies occasionally, where he's playing a kind of underdog character, and each one of the short films investigates a theme like Joe giving up smoking, or Joe trying to lose weight, or Joe worried about going bald, or Joe taking his family on a holiday and having disasters occur. They were all simple little 10-20 minute comedies, and they were immensely popular at the time. He then went on to be the voice of George Jetson in The Jetsons. So, you know, you've heard George O'Hanlon's voice for a lot of times. He eventually finished his career in 1990 when he did the voice of George Jetson for the Jetsons movie. Now, the unfortunate thing there was he was in very failing health at the time, and he had had a stroke, and his short-term memory was shot to shit. So what they had to do to get him to do the role of George Jetson, and this is somewhat distasteful, I think, is say the words to him and get him to repeat them for the microphone. That's how bad his short-term memory was. He was in a bad way and quite frail at the time. Vocally, he was okay, but his health was failing because of that stroke, which didn't affect his voice at all. And so they had to do that. Every line of dialogue you'll hear in the Jetsons movie has been spoken to George O'Hanlon, and he would then repeat it into a microphone. It seems like it was, maybe he and his family needed the money, and all credit to them for trying to make this work, but it just seems like a distasteful way to do a voiceover for a film. But that's just me. Anyway, the big draw card of this film is the 1950s gadgetry, the computers, the way that they have an optical feed from a large observatory onto what's basically a visual table that they look down on, a bit like a Microsoft Surface or one of those large flat displays that we now have, which I think is kind of cool and may have kind of influenced people designing those great big flat displays you see used on news programs now. There are a few problems with the production of the film. The budget was slashed brutally just before production started, so all of the planned visual effects and some of the planned parts of the plot had to be scrapped because they just didn't have the budget to make them work. So it's one of those films that was kind of lamed by the budget. It had a $180,000 budget at the time, but it was lamed from a much larger budget it would have had, and it may have been a much more solid movie had the budget supported that. Now, I'm sure Irving Bock did his best to make the effects work. The long shots of Kronos as it moves across the countryside are very obviously animated, the lower part of the great monster. Pretty obviously animation drawings, but in a sense that gives it a kind of charm as well. It's really an artifact of its time. It's a bit like when you see the old Kirk Allen Superman serial, and when Superman flies, it's all animated, looking a little bit like the Fleischer Superman things. You know, you accept the fact that the special effects are rudimentary. You like the fact that they tried to make them work within the budgetary and technological limitations of the time, but you know that they're cheesy. So I suppose you can approach Kronos in the same way. You know some of the special effects are cheesy, but they're trying to tell a scientific story where people think their way through a problem, as indeed did a lot of science fiction movies of the time. They didn't rely on, the good ones didn't rely on God or Deus Ex Machina endings. They had the evil that was attacking the world was destroyed through the efforts of scientifically literate and educated people. And I admire that. In a time when we all seem to yearn for simple answers that can be applied easily, having movies like this where hard work and knowledge and smarts are what save the day is kind of where we should be in a sense, which is why I've got a lot of love for the core, as I mentioned in a previous Martian Driving podcast. Yeah, the Earth, the inner core of the Earth stops revolving. We do something about it. We don't suddenly have disaster porn where everybody huddles together and doesn't try, kind of like the road, where, you know, no, we're not going to do anything about it. Everything's gone to shit. We're just going to push shopping trolleys around and die. I hate that defeatist attitude. And this movie doesn't have that. It's probably would have had a much larger cast, but it seems a little bit like three people saving the world. And a lot of the kind of the rest of the world dealing with this problem is done through newsreaders and stock footage of natural disasters. And of course, there are plot holes like this flying saucer that brought Kratos to Earth is still at the bottom of the ocean. Though, when Dr. Elliot is interrogated after it's found out that he is in contact with the aliens on the spaceship, he tells them that if Kratos fails, then they're not going to try again, and they're going to look elsewhere for the resources they need, which is a kind of nice, easy, tied up ending for that. And maybe that was part of the budgetary constraints. They had something a bit more elaborate than a disheveled looking scientist telling a bunch of other people what the aliens were thinking and doing. But having said that, I kind of like Kronos. It's a good honest effort and a little bit of fun. Nothing fancy, nothing gaudy, but I do like the forced perspective special effects. I like the fact that they didn't decide to make Kronos as fancy as, say, Robbie the Robot or something else. They went purely brutalist, rectilinear, and they made it work. The special effects sequences, while not perfect, at least when the guys land the helicopter on top of Kronos, are extremely good for the time, and I've got to admire that. Not too much else to say about it. I think that it's a little bit of fun. It's very much a kind of artifact of the science-friendly times of the 1950s, where questions scientific were not dismissed out of hand just because it was economically inconvenient to that they existed. And I always liked those 1950s helicopters. They were quite cute and quite interesting. There's another really good helicopter too. If you're into helicopter porn, there's a really good double rotor helicopter in GOG, the Ivan Tors movie from about 1954 with Gene Barry in it. When they go out to the desert, there's a really groovy looking helicopter in that, and helicopters were a large feature of those kind of films in the 1950s, and they're always a lot of fun to just take a look at the fragile little things and wonder why they stayed up in the air. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and then I'm going to get to the more serious of the two films, which is Death Watch from 1980, starring Harvey Keitel and Romy Schneider and Max von Sydow.
For you see, nothing ever happens on Mars. No sports or entertainment or screens and bars. You stand around, you stand some more on the planet named for a Roman god of war. Nothing ever happens on Mars. No supersonic airplanes.
Yes, and there is news, I said muse then, but I meant news, from the planet Mars. And in this case, it's quite film-related news from the planet Mars. It's we just celebrated the 75th anniversary of our old mate Orson Welles' War of the Worlds debacle. The broadcast was 75 years ago, a few days ago. The town of Grover's Mill is still there. And a lot of people celebrated it by replaying the original broadcast on the radio. In fact, I found out when I went in on Thursday, and the anniversary was on Wednesday, I went in on Thursday to record with my mate Ivor. He played the whole of the Orson Welles' War of the Worlds cast on his evening program on ABC local radio in Darwin. So Ivor, lovely person, and I love him more for that. He actually went the distance and played the whole lot, which is kind of cool. And I didn't realize he'd done it till afterwards, because I can't listen to his program every night. I've got other stuff I need to do, and it finishes fairly late with the current time zone differences. There's an hour and a half time zone difference between Darwin and Melbourne at the moment because of daylight saving. But all credit to Ivor for playing the Full Awesome World thing. If I know him, and I probably do, he probably snuck out for a cigar out the front of the ABC studios while it was going on. And because he does so many hours of radio with no producer, he also would have appreciated the fact that the broadcast would have made his job easier that night. I know he does a lot of work setting things up for the show, all by himself for the most part, with occasional technical assistance. But yeah, so a lot of radio stations replayed the Awesome Wells broadcast. Very, very few people thought it was real. But it's nice to celebrate these things, and I'm sure that everybody will be doing it again in 25 years' time when the centenary of the War of the Worlds broadcast rocks up. Now, I'm not sure I'm going to be around then, but I would like to be. And I'd be very happy to enjoy that celebration in 2038. So that's pretty much the news from planet Mars. Things are a little slow up there at the moment. I believe that India, by the way, has launched a Mars probe. I'm not sure how it's going to, what it's going to do, and when it's going to get there, but all credit to India for doing that. Their aerospace industry is burgeoning, and them along with the Chinese are the people to watch in this industry. So that's it for news from the planet Mars. If you find any news that you want to pass on to me, you can always email me at cultguru@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to roll it into the podcast. Given the fact that this is now going fortnightly along with Paleo Cinema Podcast, the more Martian news I get, the better.
One picture's worth a thousand words.
Never been done, has it, this kind of thing?
A new process. I'll be the first one ever to use it. Whatever I see, it's on film. Forever.
Why did you let them do that to you?
This way I'll never forget how pretty you are.
You can blink. Doesn't show at 19 frames.
Now we pause for a few brief words from our sponsors.
Whatever it is, whatever it takes, I want it fixed.
There's no cure for your condition.
How long?
2 months. Less.
She's a good choice, Vince.
You're about to become a celebrity.
They pay you to die in public.
To die young in public.
Look how shy we become about death. It's the new pornography.
There are private things.
Are there? This isn't the worst way to end a life.
This is the only death I've got to say.
This lady won't die easily, Vince.
Doesn't anyone else think what you're doing to her is obscene?
It's because it's real.
Who are you?
We can't stop now.
You risk losing everything.
Well, that's the chance we took.
What's happening? Why is it out of focus?
Do you have any regrets?
Catherine!
You are afraid. You should be. I don't want to die.
What a circus. And for what? The ratings?
Where's the camera?
Can you guess?
Okay, so Death Wash is a 1980 film directed by Bertrand Tavernier. The French title is La Mort en Direct, which means death in plain view or in plain sight. And it stars Romy Schneider as Catherine Mortenhoe, a woman. Basically, in the near future world, death through disease doesn't exist. It's been wiped out entirely. They're a bit vague about why, but just assume that it is. And the only way people die are of old age or else by accident. So death through disease is unknown in this slightly weird near future. Catherine Mortenhoe is diagnosed with a disease they can't cure, and she's offered a deal from a TV network to film her death, because these things are rare. In a sense, it's an intense kind of grief porn. And even as she's negotiating with them, they're starting to put up posters with her face on it around Glasgow, where the movie's set and filmed, which is kind of creepy. She's told of her diagnosis. The deal is put to her to film her impending death, which, as the trailer indicates, is a couple of months away. And she walks out of the doctor's surgery and sees one of these posters before the agreement is even sealed, which is kind of freaky. And basically, she signs the agreement but then flees it. She can't handle the cameras being around her all the time. She can't handle the people on the street looking at her, knowing who she is, and that kind of thing, while she's trying to deal with the fact that she's simply about to die. So she runs away and goes underground. The network decides it's not going to let her go. And a video photographer called Roddy, played by Harvey Keitel, has an operation to his eyes, which basically put in place a 24-hour-a-day video feed from his eyeballs back to the studio. And he has to track Catherine down and spend time with her so that the program has footage. Now, there are some downsides to Roddy's video eyes, one of which is if he closes his eyes, or if there's no light coming into his eyes for more than a few minutes, he'll go blind. So he always keeps a little flashlight around to shine in his eyes at night time, and he's been given drugs so that he doesn't sleep. Now, there are a number of homeless people in this new future world. They're healthy, but they're homeless. And there are also a bunch of people called marchers who protest. They're almost like gypsy protesters. Catherine and Roddy hide out amongst them, and at one stage are caught by the police. Catherine, of course, doesn't know that Roddy is filming all of this, and because they're on the streets, they don't see TV sets, so she doesn't know that the TV show is continuing. And Roddy starts to fall in love with Catherine as they're fleeing, and as her disease worsens, and she becomes partly incontinent, but defiant of the disease and of the people who are seeking to hunt her down for this atrocious television show. She asks Roddy to take her to visit her ex-husband, played by Max von Sydow. And his name is, his last name is Mortenhoe, but his first name in the movie is Gerald Mortenhoe. Who lives on the Mull of Kintyre in Scotland. So they travel across country hitchhiking and living and sleeping in shacks and things like that, so she can get her closure with her ex-husband, Gerald. Meanwhile, Roddy feels worse and worse about what he's doing, and the story progresses from there. I'm not going to give away the ending, which is quite an intense one. But this is a really interesting piece of forgotten cinema. It was made by a French director in Scotland with an American and an Austrian actress, and of course a Swedish actor, being Max von Sydow, in English. Now, there are some other really interesting people in the film as well. There's at least one. The guy who is producing the TV show, there's a guy called Vincent Ferryman, and he's played by Harry Dean Stanton, which is an incredible choice on the film. And he is a little bit like Ed Harris is in The Truman Show. He's the power behind things. He's manipulative. He's a chain smoker sitting in the studio, seeing everything that Roddy sees. And this movie very much kind of foreshadows reality TV as we know it now. If there could be cameras implanted into people's eyeballs, you could be sure that reality TV would avail itself of that technology in an instant. And then it becomes, as the film progresses, to an interesting parallel between Catherine's disease and Roddy's problems, as he needs to keep light in his eyes, otherwise he'll go blind. So his vulnerability about his vision and her vulnerability about her mortality kind of intertwine and mesh in very interesting ways. And Tavernier creates a really detailed and layered future world. Glasgow, with its grim buildings and the kind of grey, rainy weather, forms a nice backdrop to this. And the gypsy encampments where the protesters live, and there's a little market where there's a beautiful tracking shot as Catherine loses her pursuers through the market, loses the people from the reality TV show. She has a driver who's driving her around, played by Robbie Coltrane in one of his very first acting roles. And there's a beautiful tracking shot that Tavernier puts where Catherine basically ducks out on the guy and runs through this gypsy market where all sorts of things are for sale, food and technologies and clothing, devices and arts and crafts and all that. And she flees him and jumps on a ferry, on a boat, to escape him. And it's all done with one magnificent tracking shot, which basically lets her travel through this detailed kind of underworld in this future where nobody ever dies of disease. Which, it's just magnificently done. It's a bold move, and the organisation needed to do this tracking shot is quite impressive. And again, with any film of this kind, it comes down to the acting. This is one of Harvey Keitel's best acting roles. It's one of his most human acting roles. He's not posing. He's not surly and grumpy and mean-spirited the way he is in a lot of his later acting roles. He's a romantic leader, kind of street guy, photographer, with his American accent, who's brought to a decision point by the technologies that he's had implanted into himself, by the fact that he's married with a child and yet he's falling in love with this other woman, and by the fact that every day, as time goes on, his vision, the thing that he makes his living from, is imperiled by the nighttime, which is kind of cool. And then you've got the heart of the film, which is Romy Schneider. She's a great actress. She died very early. Some say of suicide, some say of a heart attack at the age of 43. Only a little while after this film was made. And she goes through an incredible character arc as well. She starts out stunned and shocked, of course, by the bad news of the death sentence she's been placed under. She kind of agrees while she's in a shock state to this horrible plan by the reality TV people to film her life. And then as she comes out of the shock, she realizes what she's agreed to and reneges on the deal. And as the story progresses and as she becomes weaker and weaker and unable to help herself and requiring Roddy's assistance in some ways, she comes to an epiphany, which really, it's a kind of blockbuster, wham, slam, hard ending to this film. But before she gets to that stage, she does have her closure with Gerald, who we only see in the last 20-25 minutes of the film. And Von Sydow is fantastic in this, and he and Schneider have such a great rapport as actors in the scenes of them reconciling and of Gerald finding out how she feels about things and assisting her in concluding the actions the way she wants to. And the humanism shown by the characters is really touching. There are very few science fiction films that engage the emotions as much as this one does. But this one definitely does. Now, I'm going to do a slight spoiler on the film to kind of wind it around. It's not going to be the big spoiler at the end. But Roddy, in anger and frustration, throws away his flashlight and goes blind. And Catherine then has to help him to complete the journey to Gerald's house so that she can have closure with her ex-husband. So her helplessness is kind of secondary to his, in a sense, towards the end of the film. He's been helping her along while she's debilitated. Suddenly he's debilitated in a much more urgent way, and she helps him. She never falls in love with Roddy, even though he's falling in love with her. But she does feel a great fondness for him, and after a certain time, she feels a responsibility for him as well, which makes the film even more poignant. Now, Bertrand Tavernier has put some... There's some stuff on YouTube of Bertrand Tavernier talking about this film, and I'm going to play a little bit of it now, just to give his viewpoint on the film. Let's see, what is it, 33 years after it was made?
One picture's worth a thousand words.
Never been done, has it, this kind of thing?
A new process. I'll be the first one ever to use it. Whatever I see, it's on film. Forever.
Why did you let them do that to you?
This way I'll never forget how pretty you are.
You can blink, then show at 19 frames.
Now we pause for a few brief words from our sponsors.
Whatever it is, whatever it takes, I want it fixed.
There's no cure for your condition.
How long?
2 months. Less.
She's a good choice, Fitz.
You're about to become a celebrity.
They pay you to die in public.
To die young in public.
Look how shy we've become about death. It's the new pornography.
There are private things.
Are there? This isn't the worst way to end a life.
This is the only death I've got to save.
This lady won't die easily, Vince.
Doesn't anyone else think what you're doing to her is obscene?
It's because it's real.
Who are you?
We can't stop now.
You risk losing everything.
Well, that's the chance we took.
What's happening? Why is it out of focus?
Do you have any regrets?
Catherine!
You are afraid, and you should be.
I don't want to die.
What a circus. And for what? The ratings?
Where's the camera?
Can you guess?
That, of course, was Bertrand Tavernier talking about Death Watch. And I did see it around the time it came out too, but I think I was in an age where I couldn't fully appreciate it, which is a shame because I would have liked to have loved this film for the past 35 years, and it's only now that I've seen it again that I love it. I think it's an important science fiction film. I think it's an important feminist science fiction film as well. But I'll leave that to other people to decide. My radar on feminism is as shaky as any other middle-aged man, white male's radar as far as feminism is concerned. But I did like the film a lot. The prurience in the film isn't sexual at all. The prurience is emotional. So there aren't any nude scenes and lovemaking scenes and things like that in the film. They'd be unnecessary were they to occur. I do like the fact that Tavernier compared Star Wars with Hopalong Cassidy. I think that's a pretty accurate summation of it, and I'm going to have to use that at some time in the future and, of course, name-check Tavernier in that, because I feel pretty much the same way about Star Wars. I think its reputation is well puffed up from what it actually is because of childhood nostalgia by the people who like it. But Death Watch is... I did get this by download. I'm now determined to pick up a copy of the DVD or the Blu-ray of it. I think it's something that I want to pay for and own in my collection. It's that important a movie. And as I've said recently about other films, the higher the quality of a movie, the less you're likely to want to watch it. Now, the reason I say that is you don't want to watch a really fine film, a movie that emotionally engages you too often, because you don't want the magic to rub off. You don't want to become familiar enough with a movie of this quality that it becomes ordinary to you. And it's really nice to have films like that. It's like, in a funny way, owning something precious that you don't want to look at all the time. If you own a magnificent work of art, you don't want to hang it on your wall. You want to keep it somewhere else where you can look at it occasionally, because if you hang it on your wall, you'll get used to it and it won't have the same resonance and the same power and the same engagement that it does if you don't see it very often. And for me, there are a number of films of which this is true. And I feel really good about that. I find it something that refreshes me with cinema. I do spend a lot of time, and I'll be honest about this, watching a lot of trash and a lot of rubbish and a lot of pretty action films and CGI extravaganzas and movies that don't touch me as much as this movie did. Because maybe I don't always want to have my emotions manipulated by a film. But usually when I am kind of deeply involved in a film, the way I was when I watched this one, it comes up on me unexpectedly. Yes, I'm going to watch this movie. Maybe I can use it for the podcast. But then the movie draws me into its world and draws me into its characters. And it never is something I planned for a movie to do. It's always something that is unexpected for me and really does touch me a lot. I mean, there's even a Charlton Heston film I feel that way about, a movie called Will Penny, which has got a lot of emotional engagement for me for some reason. It's the best movie Charlton Heston ever made. Small Western, 1968, Tom Grice directed it, Joan Hackett, Donald Pleasence, Charlton Heston. There are movies that really grab us in engaging ways, and that is kind of the important thing in cinema. Yeah, there are movies that are adrenaline shocks, and there are movies that hit you the way The Human Centipede does, but there are also these other movies where the characters and the art of the director and the writer and the cinematographer and the location manager and the actors in particular, and the music, of course, grab us a lot. It doesn't happen enough in genre films. I think there are too few genre films that emotionally engage us at more than a kind of superficial level. And this is one of them. Death Wash is definitely one of those films. Yes, it's slow-paced, and there can be the argument made that it does go on a little bit too long. But Romy Schneider at the centre of this film really does make it work. And it's an important film for that reason. It really is a lost classic of science fiction cinema that more people should know about and more people should appreciate. So I'm going to leave it there for this film. I think of the films I've done in this podcast, in some ways this is the best. And I hope to find more movies like that where science fiction is used to look at people and to look at the world and in this kind of way. And maybe I've got to tilt Martian Drive in at least partly in that direction, because that's where the good stuff is. That's where your vein of gold running through the rock is. So I'm going to take a break now and then wind things up. The feedback, I didn't get any specific feedback for the Martian Drive in podcast, but I did get some feedback, which you can hear over at Paleo Cinema Podcast, which does mention that people are listening to both podcasts. But I'm just going to take a break now and wrap this puppy up.
about me. Be happy, my love. Just say that our little show is over. And so the story ends. Why not call it a day? The sensible way. And still be friends. Look out for yourself. Should be the rule. Give your heart and your love to whomever you love. Don't be a fool, darling. Why should we cling to some fading thing that had used to be? If you can forget, don't worry about me.
That was Annie Ross, who appeared in, I think, the third Superman movie with Don't Worry About Me. That's about it for this time around at the Martian Drive-In podcast. I'll be back in 2 weeks with both podcasts one more once. In the meantime, feedback can be provided either at Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can do a voicemail, or you can email me with a voicemail, if you like, at cultguru, KULTGURU at gmail.com. In the meantime, go to the Paleo Cinema website, and down the left-hand side of the page, there are links to a whole bunch of good podcasts about movies mostly, also about music, which you should enjoy. And anyway, hi to everybody out there who podcasts, hi to everybody out there who listens to podcasts, and hi to everybody out there who doesn't listen to podcasts, though you're not going to hear me say that. I'll be back again in a fortnight. In the meantime, look after yourselves and enjoy a few good films.